meeting. But we'll jump right into some of the presentations. The first one is considerations for Minnesota's implementation of ACOs, or Accountable Care Organizations. And we have with us today David Knutson, the Senior Research Fellow from the U of M Division of Health Policy and Management at the School of Public Health. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Knutson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the work group. I'm pleased to provide some brief observations in the next 10 or 15 minutes. My first disclaimer is that my opinions are completely my own.
You know, sometimes cell phones will do that if you're close to the microphone, is what I'm told. I don't know if people
Let me flip mine off. Let me just turn mine completely off if that's the case.
Mr. Knutson, do you have any handouts or anything of this?
I have. I can produce these. I had a printer malfunction just before coming. So I have a few brief overheads, and I'd be happy to send them electronically so that the members can have them if they wish later.
Thank you.
To begin, I am a senior research fellow with the Division of Health Policy and Management at the University of Minnesota. The opinions I'll express are mine alone and not the division or the school or the university. I want to make a point that even though the title includes the term accountable care organizations, I'm really talking about accountable care. And I say that because the term ACOs, or accountable care organizations, has taken on in some circles an assumption about a structure or an organizational type. So I'm going to make some fairly high-level considerations, some formed in recommendation terms. I have not been part of the state's deliberation on accountable care, and I'm sure many of you have been part of numerous discussions over the last months and years, and so I apologize if I'm covering old ground for you. You can take my opinions as opinions that have been accumulated over two decades. In the 1980s, I directed provider contracting for a regional HMO, and then did national provider contracting troubleshooting for Aetna, and then went to work with the Park-Nicollet Institute as I got back into research, and most of my time spent on risk adjustment methodologies and new payment methods, in some cases sort of a penance for the damage we caused in the 80s, I think. And more recently at the University of Minnesota, lead a number of contracts, one with the DHS to help develop the medical home or healthcare home payment methodology. I lead a subcontract with Mathematica Policy Research developing the peer group measures. And then I have a contract with CMS where we're developing physician efficiency measures combining quality and resource use for both physicians who practice in hospital, it's an episode of care approach, and also primary care physicians, which is a total care and ACO type approach. So let me just, in some ways, cover a lot of ground, fairly high level. And again, I apologize for any ground that you've already hashed over fairly well in the past. First of all, I think it's important for this state, among many states, to review and integrate lessons from many related experiences we had. And I know citations to various historical references pop up here and there. But as someone who is, for example, involved inside the 1980s capitation backlash in which providers were suing health plans, I think some of the lessons learned have not been fully understood or expressed. Very close to patient choice, I think a lot has been written by me and my colleagues at the University of Minnesota and others about that model. That model is of continues to be of major interest to national players at Medicare and OMB and CBO. The Physician Group Practice Demonstration Project, Park-Nicollet, of course, just finishing its five-year stint and now in the process of trying to bridge this period between now and when the federal ACO options are available. In any case, I have not seen framed and coherent review of all of these lessons, aimed at trying to draw those lessons for the current implementation possibilities in front of us based on current legislation, and I think it would be useful. I think continuing a cross-payer strategy similar to the strategy the state has adapted for healthcare homes and peer grouping is really a critical success factor. It probably goes without saying that over the years, in the early days, we wondered when physician practices act capitated, what proportion of their care needed to come through capitation, and it was always a question health services researchers were asking. Over time, with the in the early days of the Buyers Healthcare Action Group patient choice model, we invited CMS to come to the Twin Cities. They did, so to try to improve or gain critical mass with regard to that program, because it seemed to be something that was in the right direction but never had the critical mass within any practice so that it was worth transforming your system. So that almost goes without saying, and I think it's it particularly applies to payment reform. I think it's important that we avoid the potentially seductive decision to just leap to full total care risk for vertically integrated or large practices with the idea that we can book the savings now and they'll figure it out. I think the history of capitation here nationally shows that we need to be more focused and targeted on where the productivity will be gained. So toward that end, I think we need to have integrated modules of risk and reward that be implemented commensurate with candidate ACO's readiness to change its practice based on its proposal that seems credible, its size and scope of services. So different types of providers, whether they be even medium-sized, relatively small primary care groups, they can be quite successful if risk is managed properly. So that means a range of sort of modules that can be integrated, and this is not, it's possible to do this. It might include bundled payments with post-acute care for groups that want to emerge out of a hospital setting and look at, in this case, would allow us to engage surgeons earlier than might be the case if we just simply start to focus on the larger ACOs and let them work it out internally. Total ambulatory care as a total care model, but maybe limit the inpatient cost exposure to only avoidable inpatient and ED costs. Or another way to look at it is maybe eliminate those large costs that are clearly not in the immediate control of a primary care group, for example, such as, say, trauma. And those are the kinds of things we're working on now in the CMS contract I described. The other thing is to establish transitional phases that build out from an initial objective of reducing avoidable readmissions. That is the sweet spot for initial savings for medical homes, really, for bundled payments, including post-acute care, for the advancing of pay-for-performance that CMS will be implementing based on ACA that I'll talk about later. And from that, focus to a total care accountability. And I think that is the common ground to start with. And if we can't make a case, or if we can't make an explicit case for that, the ACO probably isn't ready to deliver on the goods for quite a while. Secondly, we can move from a shared savings approach a la the PGP demo and where CMS is going, or something like the Buyers Healthcare Action Group version of it, which is cash flowed on a fee-for-service basis and adjusted future fee schedules up or down based on hitting a per capita target, or else it could be just upside shared savings, all the way to then performance-based episode or comprehensive care payments. That focuses on, as we've learned to describe and distinguish performance risk from insurance risk. Also, I think we need to recognize that in the ACO selection criteria that the healthcare homes, or advanced primary care as Medicare is now calling it, are key to long-term savings. There's really no other pathway that the literature supports in the long run. You can start with a focused disease management program to reduce readmissions, but if you're going to scale up and sustain it, it has to be embedded in primary care, and therefore healthcare home certification probably should be a requirement for ACO approval. In terms of measures and methods, risk adjustment methods, and this is my special area, are much improved compared to the 80s when we had so much capitation backlash, and we really did not know and have the measures to support what we were doing. And further improvements really on the horizon, some we're working on in the CMS project again, will further facilitate our ability to distinguish performance risk from insurance risk, which I think is key in not making the same mistakes we made in the past. National Quality Forum may soon meaning I don't, next year or two, endorse overuse measures for the, not if necessarily the first time, on a larger scale. Having explicit overuse measures will enhance our ability to directly measure provider efficiency in combination with cost of care or resource use, and provide more actionable information for providers. So that's on the horizon. In the area of quality measurement, Minnesota Quality Measurement Initiative is state-of-the-art anywhere you look, except maybe in some parts of in England, maybe, but that's about it. And it appears to me that it can support, over time, ACO performance measurement, just as it is being aimed now at supporting healthcare home performance measurement. And where possible, we should align measures for attribution in supporting ACOs or any form of accountable care, particularly it applies less, of course, for any inpatient episode approach than it does for a total care primary care approach. But align the measures for attribution and for computing expected costs to determine where the value is as closely as possible with the approaches taken for peer grouping. These are somewhat different applications, but they fundamentally start from some of the same premises related to accountability. So, and finally, we, as the law indicates, support the features of accountable care that are included in ACA. And I think we need to continue to align where possible with Medicare payment reform initiatives. The providers in this state will be influenced by pay-for-performance programs that are voluntary now, will be less so later. There will be opportunities for them to join other forms of payment reform. A few examples coming up for Medicare and some for Medicaid. In the pay-for-performance areas, starting in 2012, hospitals will see reduced payments starting with 1, 2, 3, 4, and then ultimately 5% of their essentially DRG, MSDRG market basket if they're on the higher end of readmission rates for selected conditions. And these are both procedures, and these are ACS or ambulatory care sensitive. So if you consider the kinds of readmissions that occur, the first kind are the kind that are related to a problem that arose in the initial admission. That's, you can see that as more clearly a hospital responsibility. The second might be ambulatory care where a sort of inadequate ambulatory care allowed for another flare-up of a heart failure or asthma and landed in another admission. Or it could be a transition in care problem, a poor handoff in which there's joint accountability between primary care and the hospital. Regardless, all of those will be in this and hospitals will be dinged. The law also extends and expands the Physician Quality Reporting Initiative, which is voluntary now and just getting started with 134 quality measures, but physicians' fee schedules will be updated. What we're working on under contract is to help support what's become called the value-based modifier, which would be used and will be used to modify fee updates for physicians and for Medicare. Bundled payments, the acute care episode demonstration project that is underway now in three or four southwestern U.S. states for a handful of orthopedic procedures and cardiovascular procedures is scheduled to be expanded as a pilot, not a demo. And that would involve bundling Part A and Part B payments, including 30 days post-acute care, into a single payment. There are some issues with that. It probably won't get off the ground as the effective date because it requires a lot of initial organizational work and establishment of a fiduciary responsible party. What we're working on for CMS is we're calling bundling light, where we just essentially create almost like a DRG for Part B so that you can apply it almost anywhere, and then it's up to the hospital and the docs to figure out how to get together. So that could maybe precede some of this. And then ACOs, Medicare Shared Savings coming in 2012, Medicaid ACO demo, and some pediatric demos that I know less about. All of these create a context for Minnesota providers and an opportunity to align and create more of that critical mass with Medicare. So with that, I think I will just, I'll end it, and maybe have a couple minutes for questions. This is fairly high level. If there's any questions about details under any of these items, especially where I'm working on that topic myself, I'm happy to respond now or in writing later.
Mr. Knudsen, I've got one question. You had mentioned on your first bullet point that we should review and integrate lessons from historic Minnesota experiences, and that you hadn't really seen a concise write-up of that as senior research fellow at the U of M Health Policy and Management with your extensive background in Minnesota's experiences historically. It seems you'd be in a unique position to help us out.
Well, I didn't mean that to be self-serving at all, but I do believe John Christensen and others in our division who have studied many of these programs and have observed the markets, we probably could do a credible job of pulling some of that together in a framework, and I think that's something we could take on just by sort of taking a meta view about everything we've done to date. It could also be that this exists and I just haven't seen it because I haven't been close to your deliberations in the past. It's just that Minnesota's experience is cited everywhere constantly. Right. And when you're inside of it, you see that, the lessons are accurate, but sometimes crude. And maybe we need a little more fine-grained set of lessons as we move forward on this and related to, again, the backlash of the 80s, patient choice, the PGP demo, and other things.
Well, if you were able to spend some time with that and found something.
I'll bring it back to the group, and I will say we will do something. In that,
okay, yeah. Thank you. Other questions? Representative Huntley.
Well, first a comment. The Commonwealth report this past April talked about what we have done in Minnesota and sort of gave the pluses and minuses, and a lot of things are sort of yet to be implemented or starting in January, so we don't really know completely what the outcome of that is. We have 3 years before 2014, and my first question is, what kind of timeline do you see for Minnesota implementing some of these things that you talked about?
Well, I think that if one builds out from elements, baskets of care, other things we're doing, uses peer grouping where it applies, and builds on the strength of the ingredients we already have, I think that our timeline, and given that we have group practice, very progressive managed care plans, I think our timeline is shorter than it will be in a lot of other places, maybe a handful of states. We would be out ahead of the federal Medicare, I think, and could be. I think that the idea of their approach towards shared savings, we're going to get some early glimpses, and I don't know if Dr. Abelson is here today. It is well known that they are negotiating with CMS for a bridge to the Medicare ACO world so they don't have to go back on traditional fee-for-service alone. Their negotiations will signal where CMS is going with regard to certain methods, and hopefully Dr. Abelson will be able to share some of that. And I think that gives us a chance to really start to implement. So given the ingredients, given we have some pretty early indications of not just what CMS is saying at the policy level, but what's in the weeds in terms of benchmarks, for example, a critical issue for providers to understand what costs are they being compared to when someone is sharing savings or doing a symmetrical risk corridor or something. We're going to have the earliest indications, probably, of many states that also have the ingredients. So that's me talking around. I don't have a specific timeline, but I could imagine providers stepping up and taking with some credible proposals on avoiding on readmission reduction within the next year, I'm guessing. I can't see why that would be so difficult. And I guess the theme here would be to not, for me, from my personal experience, and to not leap to a whole cloth, turn the process over. The problem with that, and it was true in the 80s, is that if you don't move out in a module that's easy to implement, it's easier. Nothing's easy. But then what happens is you assume you've the savings are there, and you've set some sort of risk up for the provider. But as it was in the 80s, it could be true. If, in fact, we don't have really the ability to manage and to bend the cost curve in that area, then what happens is you get pressure. And in the old days, when pressure built up in providers, I never once in my contracting days nor nationally in my studies ever heard a provider say, I'm doing poorly under quasi-capitation or capitation because I couldn't manage. It was always something wrong with the actuarials or something like that. And I think we waste years by assuming that we can go whole cloth. And so that means that implementation should be a little more straightforward. It's more complicated to build out from modules, but more straightforward in that it's more transparent, and you can really start, you can build out from where the savings really are, rather than saying pay an ACO or hold them accountable for total cost of care. Then internally they have to change their governance structure, their ways of doing things, and try to figure out what to do next, when in fact it's not a secret. We could go right to readmission reduction, for example.
When you, Representative Huntley.
Mr. Knutson, how is what we're going to do over the next 3 years going to fit in with the advanced primary care, Medicare, Medicaid application that the state has submitted?
Well, as I mentioned, as I said in one of my points, something I hold strongly to be true, and that is that that first of all, I think the healthcare home or the medical home concept is complementary and essentially a building block for an ACO, regardless how big or how integrated they are. I also think that sometimes integration may create a short-term barrier to improvement, whereas a large primary care group with total healthcare home capacity and the ability to manage its relationships with specialists and hospitals to the extent they can, less true in rural areas, is in some ways more facile and can move forward faster than some of the bigger systems. I lost my train of thought. I apologize. Representative Huntley, can you?
Complementary to ACOs.
Yeah. Okay. So basically, when Medicare initially proposed its Medicare medical home demonstration project, that is now somewhat on hold, in lieu of this recent advanced primary care demonstration, which is designed to piggyback cross-payer initiatives in states like Minnesota, they had combined already a prepayment for care coordination for the medical home with a shared savings model on the back end. The concept is not hard to reconcile, and I think the idea of showing that you have strong or advanced primary care as a requirement to credibly say that you're going to bend the cost curve, I think, is a legitimate thing to ask of an ACO that wants to take responsibility for total care. So I think they're complementary, and in some ways I think it's important to actually build out the ACO from a healthcare home base.
And my last...
Representative Huntley.
My last question is, I personally can see how this is going to work for a integrated system. But if you just look at congestive heart failure and somebody gets released from the hospital and the hospital staff is taking care of him and then he goes back to his primary care clinic, and if that's not connected to the hospital staff, how do we put those two together?
Yeah. Well, that's a good question.
Because the question is, when you get readmitted, was it because of something the hospital and the surgeons did, or was it they're not being treated when they get sent back to the primary care clinic?
I actually believe the ultimate potential to the the optimal system is a vertically integrated system for this kind of accountability in the long run. It's just that that doesn't exist, especially when I'm dealing with Medicare. It doesn't exist in most parts of the country. And so the modules are not just a matter of trying to build out with some bite-size increments, but also it fits different environments better. It is true, though, that a strong primary care system can work out. Let's imagine this situation. I mentioned that for Medicare, hospitals are starting to, we'll see a reduction if they have high readmission rates. I know already, I speak with hospitals, that they're already thinking about how do they do outreach to primary care. They're already asking what kind of primary care group should they really, to the extent a patient doesn't have a usual source of care or isn't attached, can they find responsible or accountable primary care groups, i.e., say, medical homes. So I think there will be the option of finding partnerships at critical junctures of handoffs across settings. And that same is true between primary care and specialists. And in some of the stories we hear about where medical homes have been implemented here in Minnesota in the pediatric example, but also other places, medical homes report that they do develop a new kind of relationship with the referral specialists. And they do expect that these patients are returned and that there's a feedback information and that the consult is a consult until it comes back to primary care. They have a new sense of what their role is. And I think that that can play itself out even without organizational integration, as long as it's a natural next step, meaning a handoff between a discharge planner or a hospitalist and a primary care physician, and that they can work out a mutual relationship. And there's examples of that in geriatrics. Is that as good as being part of the same firm? Probably not. But we don't have that option in a lot of parts of the state or the country right now.
One second. Mr. Knutson, you keep talking about rather than jumping to ACOs in whole cloth, building it through modules. And I'm just wondering if you could help us. What do you vision as a module? Are you building a module around a diagnosis or a chronic condition or a discrete population of some sort? Or what are you? Yeah. What's your
module? Well, I think it shouldn't be more. I make it sound more complicated. I think it really is about separating and getting a clear view of what you want to happen with admissions in post-acute care. Some of those admissions are not avoidable. And so you're interested in the sequelae after, like the case. Others are could be avoided with better ambulatory care. We know, and so what I'm thinking about more is where you develop accountability for cost that is really commensurate with your influence, and the place where you can sort of play with that is between an episode approach for inpatient care, recognizing that it's all becomes part of a total care approach, and we want that. We want the substitution, the creativity, but if we're going to sort of build out, the other thing is it gives us a chance to get surgeons and hospitalists explicitly in the mix right away. And so it's really just that. It's not anything more complicated. And when I think of total care and I think of excluding costs that would produce shocks for smaller systems in an actuarial sense, then I think it supports the sort of the fact that the medical home is in a few sites together could become accountable for total cost of care.
That helps. Representative Bunn.
Thank you, Mr. Knutson. You've already touched on my core question to some extent in your last two answers, which is having to do with what does the drive towards our movement towards peer grouping, bundling, and healthcare homes, and then ultimately ACOs mean in terms of the industry structure. You've already said explicitly just a few minutes ago that you view probably optimally that it's going to be a vertical integration approach. So I'm concerned about where the trade-off is between the delivery system delivery advantages and economies are for having a more vertically integrated and larger system structure versus, you know, decreased competition and choice and those other kinds of things we may value, consumers and the public. So where do you see the industry structure being potentially driven by these changes we're talking about?
That's a good question. And in terms of issues related to competition and market power and that, I would have to defer to those more expert than I. I do believe that when I mentioned the modular approach, and even though I think that an organization that is vertically integrated has at least the tools at its disposal, you know, common IT and everything that should allow it to be the most cost effective. Mm-hmm. Whether that is should be traded off against creating monopolies, and I doubt it. And I think it's this virtual approach and the fact that in some places they will be very good at determining where and helping influence their patients who have linked to them in some way, shape, or form, whether it's soft steerage of a coinsurance or whether it's a post-hoc attribution or actual enrollment, that they will influence where they go for surgeries, for example, and that can happen even in a rural setting. Mm-hmm. Although it is true that there's a limitation on access and which hospitals and whether you really can, with travel time, really play that hand. And again, there is a limit. And so I think it's going to be balancing the competitive issues with the integration issues. And I don't think that vertical integration will really be the optimal mm-hmm. organizational structure that will balance all of those objectives everywhere. So,
other questions? If not, thank you, Mr. Knudsen. It was very insightful. We'll look forward to something more on the history. And Charlie Fazio has a limited time schedule, so we're going to go to a discussion of current experience with ACO care delivery systems, and we're going to take up Medica's with Charlie Fazio.
Nothing electronic with
me.
Chris Kim. I also don't know where my presentation is. While he's looking for the presentation, Mr. Chair, maybe I can go ahead and start.
Yeah, we've got the handouts in our packet, so we can.
Is there any chance this is one of the other microphones and not mine?
Yeah, there is a chance of that. We can just turn it off if it keeps doing that.
I'm Charlie Fazio. I'm the Chief Medical Officer at Medica. I think my comments about the changes we've made in how we attempt to pay for care over the last 6 to 8 years will be very consistent with what Mr. Knudsen described, and we'll get just a little bit more into the weeds and the detail without getting too far into the detail. And so you can see at the bottom of the first page, I'll talk a little bit about the evolution of the programs, how the programs have followed much the same evolution that Mr. Knudsen described, and then some policy considerations, I think, as we try to move forward as a community. The top of the second page, what's labeled slide 3, was probably not news to anybody in this group, but it was what drove us to think about paying for care differently. If providers only get paid for encounters, and encounters only occur when people are sick, then we're going to keep generating encounters, and we were looking for something different than that. The evolution that Mr. Knudsen described is sort of described at the bottom of the second page, I think, and it's how we approach changing how we pay for care. 10 years or so ago, when the emphasis in the community was gaps in care, and how we look at chronic disease and the care that people were getting for chronic disease. We had ICSI developing guidelines. We had practices looking to implement those guidelines. And I think a number of us around the community were looking to say, how could we support that? So at the health plan level, what you had was the introduction of disease management programs to try to help fill in some of those gaps in care. And on the payment side, you had pay for performance. So how could we help support some of the costs incurred as you try to get a practice changed to be more in line with guidelines? And I think that was a good start for the community. Over time, what people found was as they complied with the guidelines, there were other barriers involved. And a lot of those barriers were around the idea that optimal care for a person with a chronic disease had nothing to do with the visit, often didn't need a visit, but wasn't something that we paid for, which is how we started talking about clinic-based disease management. I mean, that's what we called it internally for a long time, was clinic-based chronic care. How do we get out of the disease management business at the health plan level and pay for it and support it in the delivery system? And so we are in a transition out of that kind of a program and into what has come to be called either the healthcare home or the medical home. And we've been paying for those for a while and studying how we do that. At the point where a practice is organized around a medical home and wanting to do less and less in the context of an encounter, you get a practice that's very interested in thinking about total cost of care. How much can I recreate how I deliver care, and will the payment system support that? But I agree completely with Mr. Knutson. We've not recognized any ability to have an on-off switch and go from one to the other. It takes an awfully long time to